Hello, I'm Rocket Rob Asmus. This is number 0387, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0387. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on the show, looking at NASA's future in a new presidential administration. Is he concerned?
A little bit, although the people that they're bringing in are certainly a good scientifically and specifically engineering-grounded team. Interestingly, there's a fellow professor from USC who is a professor of entrepreneurship, which I thought was an inspired choice. And although Elon Musk wasn't brought in on the NASA transition group, he has been brought in as an economic advisor. So it's not that there's going to be any dearth of good advice. It's how much of it is taken, and you know, regardless of how that affects the administration, you've still got Congress to deal with, and what are they thinking? And that's something that probably won't change a whole lot real quick.
MJ Doherty, author of Life Lessons from a Total Failure. Why does he call himself a total failure?
Well, you know, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but certainly if there's a way to fail, I have failed time and time again. And even as I grow and learn in this crazy life, I still am going to fail, and I've kind of embraced it as being my thing. You know, I'm a total failure who can see the bright side of failure and use it to propel me to where I want to be.
Bob Woolsey, author of The General's Briefer, about his days working in the Pentagon.
As a horrible soldier, as you know, the guys that shoot the guns and run the mile. But I had a pretty good career at the Pentagon. I was there for about 18 months. I was a lawyer for a while, and I wasn't crazy about being a lawyer. But I did like the time that I spent at the Pentagon, and maybe other people would like to hear to read about it, too. I was awestruck when I first got my orders that, you know, you ought to report it to the Pentagon. And I went to this hush-hush office that they gave top-secret briefings every morning, and I was appointed as the oral briefing officer.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0387 was Rocket Rob Asmus, who back in the day was a producer on my old radio show. Yes, the Rocket Rob Asmus. Today, he is a librarian in the entertainment industry working in Los Angeles, California. Thank you, Rocket Rob, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 71-year-old Larry Harmel was arrested in Baltimore, Maryland by an undercover police officer who was posing as a prostitute after he allegedly agreed to pay her for sex. The arrest led him to resign from his position as the executive director of the Maryland Chiefs of Police Association. Harmel, a 30-year state trooper and a former police department chief, was arrested at the place where he took the officer for the deed, a graveyard. An attorney for the MCOPA noted that Harmel is, quote, a long-storied, exemplary law enforcement officer and a public servant who's got an unblemished career, unquote. Well, more accurately, had an unblemished career. Wow. Going to a graveyard for sex. You know, it's kind of fitting, actually. I mean, his career is dead. Yeah. Now, as you know, on the Stuff File program, we feature each week the segment by Bob DiRigo Jones called Let's Be Fair that takes a look at fraudulent lawsuits. Well, I'd be curious to know what Bob thinks of this one because it definitely takes the cake. James Leslie Kelly says he went to a Verizon store in Highlands County, Florida, and spent an hour and a half there, and what the company did was so negligent, it caused him a loss of civil liberties and freedoms. That's why he's suing for $72 million. Bet you're curious what the cause of this is, eh? Bet you really want to know. Well, here it is. If the Verizon employee he dealt with hadn't let him get $300 worth of goods and services from Verizon using the identity of a customer with a similar but not identical name, he would not now be serving a 10-year sentence for doing so. Wow. You know, if his freedom is worth $72 million, then why did he risk it for $300? I think that's a fair question to ask, don't you? The Florida Highway Patrol said a man is facing felony charges for using a remote control device to hide his license plate and avoid paying a $1.25 toll. The FHP said a trooper spotted Joshua Concepcion West using the mechanism to lower a shield that covers his license plate while approaching a toll plaza in Orlando. These devices are specifically designed to obscure your tag, FHP Sergeant Kim Montez told local news. Montez said the method of toll evasion is kind of James Bond-like, where this device is activated remotely. She said a trooper saw the shield both lower and rise. West was arrested on felony charges for petty theft and cheating, or gross fraud. Now he is charged with a felony for failure to pay a $1.25 toll, Montez said. Different types of gadgets are available online that are designed to hide license plates. They generally retail from $50 to $200. You know, I am certainly not condoning this kind of action, and I'm glad he's been caught. But on the other hand, you have to admire his ingenuity. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a 15-year-old boy in Ferndale, Michigan, called 911 to report his grandmother had pulled a gun on him. Police say 66-year-old Jacqueline Dorothea Wedlow had demanded that the unnamed grandson's 22-year-old brother get out of the shower since she was upset to get a $1,000 water bill. He refused. Wedlow then allegedly got a rifle and told the 15-year-old to get his brother and get out, or they'd have their heads blown off. The boy managed to get his brother to safety, and they called police. Wedlow is charged with felonious assault and domestic violence and released on bond on the condition that she stay away from the house and her grandsons. Well, gee, who's going to pay future water bills now? You know, do you think she was really upset about the water bill or just overly concerned about teenage boys who take excessively long showers? Interesting. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? NASA expert Rod Pyle is back with us as we embark in this new year and also a new administration in the United States. I thought it might be timely to look at what's on the docket for NASA and what their future might hold. Rod's latest book is Amazing Stories of the Space Age. He joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program. So, as I mentioned, new administration coming in, is that a good thing, bad thing, cause for concern as far as NASA is concerned?
Hold on, let me look at my magic eight ball. Okay, the answer's coming up. Answer is hazy. We're trying to figure that out. There's been a lot of trying to figure that out. I was at a working group up in Mountain View a few weeks ago where we put together a position paper. I was a minor contributor, but a bunch of NASA people put together a position paper that they sent to the administration, and it got acknowledged. And, you know, when we were doing it, we thought we were sending it probably to a different administration, but it ended up going to the Trump incoming administration. And it seemed that some of the ideas were probably going to get a general nod, but a lot of that's long-term thinking. I think the big question for the NASA folks, they have a group, there's a transition team, and then there's a group that enables the transition team for NASA for the new administration, which is formally, I believe, called the Landing Party, and formally, from whatever from the NASA folks, called the Boarding Party, but whatever they're calling it, you know, everybody's wondering what the new direction will be if there is a new direction. So the latest stuff I've read from people who are steeped in this, know a lot more about than I do, is don't expect big changes anytime soon. But just my own reading of it and of a number of other folks in the trade is, you know, an awful lot of the people that are in this group, this new steering group for NASA, are pro-moon, and they're not anti-Mars, but I think there's a sentiment that, you know, just recently even we found out some more difficulties about long-term space flight. The overall Mars project idea, I can't even say it's a project yet, but the idea, the journey to Mars, NASA calls it, hasn't really gotten a lot of funding yet. We're still figuring out how to finish the space launch system on Orion capsule. Do we finish that system? How many launches will it make in this decade? How many launches will it make altogether? So there's a lot of head scratching over that. So I think if we do see a pivot, it will probably be two things over time. One might be looking at going back to the moon, or at least spending more time in cislunar space than was being considered, although that was always a part of it, but landing wasn't. And then secondarily, it feels like there may be a little bit of a pivot away from down-looking Earth science, but we don't really know.
Well, there was a concern with this administration coming in that it seemed to be, on, at least on the surface, somewhat of a has somewhat of a scientific deficit. Is this something that bothers you or concerns you?
A little bit, although the people that they're bringing in are certainly a good scientifically and specifically engineering grounded team. Interestingly, there's a fellow professor from USC who is a professor of entrepreneurship, which I thought was an inspired choice. And although Elon Musk wasn't brought in on the NASA transition group, he has been brought in as an economic advisor. So it's not that there's going to be any dearth of good advice. It's how much of it is taken. And, you know, regardless of how that affects the administration, you still got Congress to deal with. And what are they thinking? And that's something that probably won't change a whole lot real quick. But there does seem to be a trend towards at least the big question of, okay, well, the climate's changing, but is it man-caused or is it not? And we all have our opinions about that. I think if I were to sort of take the temperature of the administration, it would be, we don't think there's enough evidence. So the question then becomes, you know, NASA spends a lot of money on Earth science. Now, Earth science isn't just looking at climate change, and it's not pushing the panic button. Earth science is about gathering data, looking at these patterns of changing temperatures and so forth, measuring wave height, measuring ocean temperature, and that data goes to NOAA and other groups in the U.S. and internationally, and it's used for agriculture and all kinds of stuff. So it's a lot more than, you know, the idea that NASA is saying, hey, we're in trouble. That's really not their role, although there is some of that. But really, they're gathering data and giving it to people who need it, letting them draw their conclusions. So I think the question for a lot of us is, okay, is that going to change substantively? And we'd like, I think, in general, to see Earth science continue.
Well, what is on the immediate docket for NASA in this year and coming years?
Well, on the unmanned side, or the robotic side, we have Mars 2020 getting ready to go. And that's another rover, very much like Curiosity, except it's got a core sample drill. Instead of just a drill, it brings up powder. And it will be taking core samples, evaluating some of that material, storing some of that material in little casks on the ground. It'll be picked up by a mission yet to be determined. There's another one, which name escapes me at the moment, but it's a seismic measuring device, and so it's looking at seismic activity and heat flow. That's a lander. And then on the human spaceflight side, we got the space station going for at least another 7 years, maybe longer. There's a question there about whether the Russians are going to stay with it or not. They've said we want to take one of our modules and go do something else with it. So, but at least till 2024. So we've got a lot more flights going there. And then on the commercial side, of course, over the next year and a half, 2 years, we've got both SpaceX and Boeing, both of whom just got another batch of contracts from NASA for delivering personnel to the space station once they start doing that. So in the next year, year and a half, they've got to start making their preliminary crewed flights, and that's going to be a huge sea change because we won't be paying the money, $82 million per single seat, to the Russians for the Soyuz ride up to what is, you know, a collaborative space station. We'll be hiring people here in the U.S. to do it, and that'll be substantively cheaper over time.
Has the U.S. done damage to itself with the use of other countries' rockets to get them into space? In other words, it's been a while since the shuttle program and nothing to replace it. Was that a mistake, and is that something that can be corrected, or has it done irreparable damage?
I don't think so. You know, that gets argued about a lot. The shuttle was old. The shuttle was always expensive. It never really fulfilled its promise to be an easily or quickly or inexpensively reusable system. It was only partially reusable, and refurbishing the solid rocket boosters in the orbiter was quite expensive and time-consuming. So, and at one point, they were talking to about a flight a week back before the thing actually started flying. By the time we got it going, we were lucky to get one every couple of months on average. So, you know, the shuttle had sort of passed its prime and was beginning to cost an awful lot of money. Should we have had something to replace it right away? Ideally, yeah. Had more money been put by Congress into commercial space, we might have had something already going. But, you know, these guys can only move so fast and it's expensive. But that said, both SpaceX and Boeing, which is more expensive than SpaceX, are going to end up being a lot cheaper than the SLS and the Orion, which is well into the double-digit billions now, and we still don't have anything flying and won't for a few years. So, you know, is it a slowdown? Yeah, but I think the damage is probably more psychological than it is technological at this point. You know, NASA and U.S. Technology in general seems to be able to ramp up pretty fast, and there's a distinct mission and a budget attached to it. The problem is those priorities keep getting shifted. Every time we have an administration change or a set of congressional elections, those priorities tend to move around and wiggle, and that can move the needle in the right direction or the wrong direction.
I have just a few minutes to go, but I mentioned earlier that you have a new book out, Amazing Stories of the Space Age. Tell us a little bit about it.
This was a book that I had actually been pitching for a TV show about 10 years ago, and we got close, but it didn't get done. So I thought, you know, I'm going to repurpose this as a book proposal. And Prometheus finally signed off on it. So it's really a look at mostly the space age. It starts in Nazi Germany, goes through the space age and up into the 80s, but most of it's focused on space age. The bulk of the book is missions that we considered doing but didn't do, like the Army wanted to build a base on the moon in the 1950s and staff it with soldiers and, you know, keep the red threat from taking lunar territory away from us and being able to hurl nuclear bombs on Earth, that kind of thing. Werner von Braun had a big Mars plan back in the early 50s to send a whole fleet to Mars. There were considerations about using the Gemini spacecraft for military purposes to possibly intercept and otherwise disrupt Russian satellites or possibly spacecraft in orbit. So it's those kind of stories, plus a few incidents from missions that did fly that we didn't hear much about, like they had an emergency, potential emergency, after the Apollo 11 landing that was kept pretty quiet for a while in the descent stage that got worked out, but it didn't necessarily have to get worked out. So just talking about those kind of things, and it's been getting very good reactions so far, so I'm very optimistic it comes out on Tuesday.
Would you, could this book be a possible springboard to what you originally had planned, and that is a television series?
Possibly. I've had meetings with two companies that have been discussing options, so we'll see what happens. It's always a big question mark when you're working in television because it's hard to know what the network's going to want. But, you know, if I was in that seat, I'd want it because it's cool. So we'll see. There's a good chance.
Rod, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you once again for sharing your NASA expertise with us on the program.
My pleasure, anytime.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. His latest book is Amazing Stories of the Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0387, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll learn some life lessons from a total failure. Plus, we'll also talk to a guy who used to work at the Pentagon. We have an idiot of the day coming your way as well a little later on, and much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way to Listen to Radio. Well, Kay Lewis of Kansas City, Missouri, says two strangers asked her for a ride. She decided to be safe and declined. After spending an evening at the movies with her boyfriend, Lewis left her car parked on the street. The next morning, she discovered the ignition switch on her steering column was broken off. She also discovered something else. "I looked down and I saw a wallet on the ground," Lewis said. "It was an ID with a picture matching the guy that I saw the night before." She believes the would-be thief followed her and her boyfriend after they denied the two men a ride, which seems like a lot of work given the state of Lewis's 1985 Oldsmobile. "It's a piece of crap," she said. "I bought it for $300 and have put like a couple hundred worth of work into it." She says police couldn't help her since nothing was stolen, and she stopped short of calling the man whose name is being withheld. "It's such a hilarious, classic, stupid criminal story," she said. "When I found the wallet, I was literally looking around like, am I being punked?" Well, you know, the story alone may double the value of the car. Just think about it. And Tawanda A. Shields plays the lottery a lot and gets very upset by the fact that she doesn't win. This according to Detective Robert Appleby of the Lower Swatara Township, Pennsylvania Police. Now, according to police, state lottery employees have been getting threatening phone calls and voicemails from Shields. She went as far as saying that she had paid some guys to hurt people, said the detective. The threat got worse and worse. Appleby said Shields thought the lottery was engaging in a conspiracy against her, and that she was protected from prosecution by freedom of speech and by using burner phones to call in the threats. Nevertheless, a warrant was issued for her arrest. I'm assuming now she'll probably believe that the conspiracy is bigger than she thought. Yeah. What a dim bulb. Hamden, Connecticut High School was put on lockdown for an hour on December 15th when a student was seen running in the hallway, zigzagging from side to side, swinging an arm and leaping into the air. Police were called but quickly learned that it was just a 12th grade boy practicing a basketball move and pretending to dunk. Well, people do keep saying if you see something, say something. I guess perhaps they should clarify what it is they are seeing first. 35-year-old Shad Gaspard was at a convenience store in Coral Springs, Florida, when a man came up to him in an apparent robbery attempt. "He lifted up his shirt and showed me he had a gun," Gaspard said. By instinct, Gaspard simply reached over and grabbed the gun out of the robber's waistband. He was like, "Yo, give me the gun back," Gaspard said. He tossed the gun on the floor where it shattered. Police later said it was a BB gun. "He wasn't listening, so I grabbed him by the back of the neck and took him outside, and I put him on the ground and I put his hands behind his back, put my knee on his wrist so he couldn't move them. Gaspard simply held him there until police arrived and took 35-year-old Jason Felix into custody. The 6'7", 280-pound Gaspard is not simply a big guy. He's also a former pro wrestler and bodyguard for celebrities such as boxer Mike Tyson and has been training in mixed martial arts since the age of 8. So basically, we know that poor Felix never really stood a chance. But then again, if you're going to use a BB gun to commit a robbery, perhaps you should pick a target who isn't 6'7" and 280 pounds. Just a little advice. In October, officials of Alaska's Iditarod reaffirmed an earlier decision to allow mushers to use mobile phones during the 2017 race. Purists maintain that phones destroy the frontierness of the event. Well, I think so does Gore-Tex, but that's just me. Now, do the dogs get to use phones too? I guess the mushers must be texting, because who can talk over all that barking? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in October, Chicago Alderman Howard Brookins Jr. publicly denounced aggressive squirrels that were gnawing through trash cans and costing the city an extra $300,000. A month later, Brookins was badly injured in a bicycle collision, which resulted in a broken nose and missing teeth when a squirrel, in either a mighty coincidence or suicide terrorism, jumped into one of his wheels, sending Brookins over the handlebar. Wow, I keep saying, if those little rodents ever develop opposable thumbs and learn to open doorknobs, we're all doomed. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We're in the middle of January, and I'm assuming that if you did make New Year's resolutions, they're already broken. So how do you feel about that? Well, let's think positive as we talk to storyteller MJ Doherty, who is a best-selling author, and his new book is Life Lessons from a Total Failure. In it, he opens up about how the worst decisions he made in life turned into his best. MJ joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, MJ.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. You know, right off the bat, for the record, I have to state that I have never at any time made a New Year's resolution, so I have none to break.
What? That's amazing. You are one of the few, one of the very few.
I have none to, but for those who made them and have already broken them in this early stage of 2017, it's not all for naught, right?
No, not at all.
So you recommend, and again, the title of your book, Life Lessons from a Total Failure. First of all, why do you call yourself a total failure?
Well, you know, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but certainly if there's a way to fail, I have failed time and time again. And even as I grow and learn in this crazy life, I still am going to fail, and I've kind of embraced it as being my thing. You know, I'm a total failure who can see the bright side of failure and use it to propel me to where I want to be.
You know, that's an attribute that a lot of people don't have. As a matter of fact, the reverse of that is also something that few people have, and that is sometimes they can't enjoy their successes. Do you think one goes hand in hand sometimes when people can't learn from their failures, they also can't really enjoy their successes?
Yeah, definitely. I think they're the two sides of one coin. It's not really knowing how to just be in the moment and embrace yourself and your life for what it is and take it for what it's worth.
So it's not necessarily the destination, but the journey.
Absolutely. Most people don't even think about the journey, and it's not till after it passes, whether the journey was a good one or a bad one, they even have time to reflect and take in, you know, what it meant to them and what they got from it.
I mentioned in the introduction, you're a storyteller. You're also an actor and a motivational speaker. What made you write this book?
Well, you know, honestly, it was one of these things that I, you know, love to talk. I say right in the beginning of the book, I was always a talker, you know, never really thought of myself as being an author. But as I started telling my story to people and sharing all the failures that I've had in my life and how I kind of overcame things like depression and bankruptcy and eating disorders and all these crazy things, and how I got from, you know, nothing, homeless, to, you know, bankrupt, to being on sets in Hollywood, people really were responding to me. And as soon as I opened up about me and told them about the shame and pain I felt in my failures, it let them start to open up and tell me about their failures. And it kind of opened a window to let a dialogue start. And it was such an amazing thing that I realized, you know, so many of us live with things that hang over our head, these black clouds of things that we wish didn't happen, or failures, or what have you. And I kind of, you know, had seen through my own journey that, hey, you know, if it wasn't for those failures, I wouldn't be where I am now, which is in a place that I never could have imagined, and I'm so happy. I thought, well, you know, this story of being broke and bankrupt to being on TV, people can understand that I kind of made a journey there. So maybe they'll believe me when I tell them, like, it's okay, you're going to be okay. And, you know, you don't have to feel pain and shame. And that was really important to me. So I decided, you know what, let's see if I can put my words in, you know, into literal form, and sat down, and it kind of flowed out and was very cathartic. And then, as you know, I started sharing it with people were really responding, and wouldn't you know it, then I have a best-selling book. It was pretty amazing.
Was there a period of time, or did it take you a period of time to come to that realization, or were you just a pretty positive person all the way around, even while going through the failures? Was there a time when you, you know, for lack of a better term, wallowed in it?
Oh, God, yes. I was MJ Wallower. I mean, it was why me, everything happens to me, poor me, 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 you know, and my lows were pretty low. And, you know, I mean, I tried to take my life, and I really thought that I would never be okay again. And it was, you know, such a dark time that I understand now when people feel so down, they feel so depressed, and they feel like it's never going to be okay. And that's why, for me, it was so important to let people know that it will be okay, because I've been there, I felt it, I really believed it. And it wasn't till I kind of, you know, fought through and asked for help and started talking to people instead of hiding, you know, that I really found how to be positive and how to move forward, and really how to, like, cling on and you know, hold on for dear life. And when then that happened, you know, I started to become a, you know, much more positive person, and understood myself a lot better, and then really started living my life for me and being a happy, well-rounded person.
And when you were going through the dark times, what was it like for friends and family? Did you reach out to them? Were you afraid to reach out to them? Did anybody turn their back on you, for instance?
Well, those are a lot of questions. They're tough ones, you know, because I want to say that everybody was there for me, but they weren't. But that wasn't their fault. A lot of them didn't know. I didn't tell people. And the people I did tell, I told too much to, and I overwhelmed them. And, you know, the people that stuck by my side are, you know, the people that I know understood me and love me, you know, fully. But, you know, I did lose a lot of people. I lost a lot of friends, and have, you know, some relatives whose our relationship was strained. You know, one relative has still never spoken to me this day, you know, because of things that happened. And all that stuff just kills you. You know, it just rips you apart. And you have a tendency to dwell on that, on the people that hate you and the people that are upset with you and the things that you've done wrong. And you overlook the people that were there standing by you, picking you up, helping you, holding you. And, you know, now I don't worry about those people anymore. I don't worry about that stuff, because I did have great people supporting me, and I appreciate what they did then and who they are to me now.
So when did you decide that you needed to, you know, beyond taking care of yourself, that you really needed to share this story in the form of life lessons from a total failure?
When did I decide?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
When things started to go, you know, again, it was, you know, as my life started to get better, I started talking to people and being more honest. And the more I started talking to people, the more people started telling me about their stories. And it was at that time that I realized, like, you know what? I can tell my story. I have enough confidence in myself that I don't have to hide it. I can tell people now all the things I did wrong. And if I do that, and I can help another person think, all right, well, he went through all this and he's okay, maybe I'll be okay, and I can help them let go of some of the pain and shame they have, then, you know, why wouldn't I do that? I mean, isn't that kind of our responsibility here, as you know, in this world, as a global community? Like, we make our mistakes, we figure something out, so I'll tap someone on the shoulder and tell them what you learned, because maybe you can help spare them from the same thing that you went through.
It sounds like you have managed to do what so few manage to do, and that is release emotional baggage. Would that be correct?
Yeah, but don't get me wrong. There's still baggage there. I got baggage for days, baby. But, you know, I know how to deal with it now. So it's not so much that I got rid of it. It's just I've learned how to organize it a little bit better and kind of, you know, keep it where it needs to be so I can live my life. Because, you know, when you have really traumatic things, they don't go away, but I don't want them to go away. In my book, I talk about them being like the first seasons of my TV show. And they're there for me to pull out and look at so I can remember what happened, so I can learn from it, and I don't forget those lessons, and then for me to put back. So they're always there, and I like it that way because I need to remember it, need to draw from it, and know it was part of my life.
What's it like for you as a motivational speaker to share your story with people and get reactions from them based on what you have to say?
It's the most rewarding, fulfilling thing any person can ever do, is to talk and tell a story and be genuine about your own life experience, and then have people come up hugging you, crying, thanking you for touching them, and for them feeling like they can now share their story. And when they tell, you know, I get emails from people saying, you know, I read your book and the next day I decided, you know, I'm done living my life like this. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to change things. I mean, there's no money that could buy happiness or fulfillment like that. It's so touching, and it's such an honor. I can't believe that this is my life, and I'm just very thankful for it.
The book is called Life Lessons from a Total Failure, written by MJ Doherty. MJ, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
MJ Doherty, author of Life Lessons from a Total Failure. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0387, and you'll find links to MJ's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Job providers often say that one of the biggest problems they have when trying to create more jobs is complying with all the government regulations there are today. Americans seem to understand. In a nationwide Gallup poll taken shortly before the election, twice as many people said that there is too much government regulation compared to those who said there is too little. So, how do we tackle this problem then? Well, just prior to his election, Donald Trump said that for every new regulation created, two existing regulations must be repealed. That proposal has been called either bold or radical, depending on who you talk to. But did you know it's actually worked elsewhere? In 2010, Great Britain instituted a one-in, two-out rule to reduce government red tape there, and it proved so effective, it was recently expanded to one-in, three-out. Let's be fair, it's time to get serious about this in the U.S., too. Let's end the old roach motel system where regulations check in, but they never check out. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about working at the Pentagon. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And, of course, a few more Stuff File news stories right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, an armed robber at an adult store in California fled empty-handed when the shop's two female employees pelted him with sex toys. The incident, which was recorded by security cameras, began when a man with his face covered walked into Lotions and Lace in San Bernardino and brandished a gun. With the gun, he walked in. I just thought he was trying to be funny to scare us, a store employee identified only as Amy told local news. But then I saw the gun, and it was like, really? I don't have time for this. Amy said she believed the gun to be a fake, so she started yelling at the man, who eventually grabbed her. The second employee, who did not want to be named, then started throwing sex toys at the robber. The man fled the store empty-handed. I think he was a coward, the second employee said, coming in and trying to get over on two females and not realizing that we're pretty feisty. The store congratulated the two workers. Do you recognize this man? Attempted robbery at the San Bernardino Lotions and Lace on Wednesday night. We are happy our ladies are safe, but they sure are tough. San Bernardino police said they are working to identify the suspect, whose uncovered face was photographed by an outside security camera. Police said they generally don't recommend confronting armed robbers. Although I doubt most robbers are expecting to get hit with battery-powered penises in the face. Or would that be peni? Gotta check on that one. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a balding Florida man has been sentenced to 2 years in prison for stealing hair growth formula in a series of thefts in Ohio. 36-year-old Andres Arias was arrested in October in Ohio on a charge of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity. Or would that be a pattern of male baldness? Anyway, Ohio media dubbed him the Balding Bandit after surveillance footage showed the balding man taking the hair growth products off store shelves. According to the Ohio Attorney General's office, between December and February of 2015, Arias flew to cities in Ohio, rented cars, and drove to various pharmacies where he would steal items such as Rogaine and weight loss supplements worth thousands of dollars. Arias would slip the items into his pockets and walk out the door. He would later ship the items to associates in New Jersey who would deposit money into his bank account. Arias was also arrested in August in Palm Beach County on an out-of-state fugitive charge stemming from theft charges in Alabama. In May, he was arrested by Boca Raton police for driving under the influence and driving on the wrong side of a divided highway. On top of the 2-year prison term, Arias was ordered to pay $22,000 in restitution. So, off to jail for Arias. Well, hair today, gone tomorrow. Anyway, let's get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? When one thinks of the U.S. Pentagon, rarely does the idea of it being a house of laughter cross people's minds, but humor can be found anywhere, and Bob Woolsey has been mining it. He's a former U.S. Army intelligence captain and the author of The General's Briefer. Bob joins us on the line right now from New Jersey. Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. You, as I said, were a former U.S. Army intelligence captain. Obviously, since you've written this book and it's filled with humor, that you yourself have a sense of humor. What made you feel it important to get this out there and let people know that it's not all, you know, serious business at the Pentagon?
Well, I was thinking over my brief Army career, 2 years, and I was a horrible soldier, as you know, the guys that shoot the guns and run the mile. But I had a pretty good good career at the Pentagon. I was there for about 18 months. And I was a lawyer for a while, and I wasn't crazy about being a lawyer. But I did like the time that I spent at the Pentagon, and I figured that maybe other people would like to hear to read about it, too. I know I was awestruck when I first got my orders that, you know, you ought to report to the Pentagon. And I went to this hush-hush office that they gave top-secret briefings every morning. And that I was appointed as the oral briefing officer.
And that is exactly what? What is the oral briefing officer?
Yeah, I came in at the madhouse around from 5:45 until the book went out at about 20 minutes after 7. And we got reports from different desk officers from Latin America, Africa, Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, China, Vietnam. And they prepared more reports. They started filtering them into the colonel in charge. he put them in this thing called Black Book. And at 7:20, he said, go. And I just quick timed it over to the war room and just took my place at the podium. And I read from the book for about 10, 15 minutes. And I asked, do you have any comments or questions? And usually the general would say, no. And then I gave a courtesy briefing. These were all pretty big guys. I mean, they had a two-star general who was the head of Army Intelligence. Then I had to give the same briefing to the head of operations. That was a three-star general. In Army terms, this is pretty important people that I was briefing. But then I'd come back and discuss the briefings with the colonel. And really, about 10:30, the day was over. We did things like, we did courtesy briefings to the public, you know, tours would come around, and we'd give non-classified briefings. But that was it, and then the beginning was great, it was just 5 days a week. Then they, toward the end of my tour, they increased it to 6 days a week. We had a brief on Saturdays. But when I think about all those poor kids that were dying overseas, you know, being shipped home in body bags, I had a very, very good tour. 2 years of I call it rest and relaxation.
Now, what time frame are we talking about when you were working at the Pentagon?
I couldn't hear you at the beginning of that.
Sorry, what time frame were you working?
This was I got to the Pentagon in July 1968, and I left in March of 1970. And some of the book, the beginning, say the first third of it, deals with my everybody has to take the basic training infantry course, you know, running around and jumping and firing at targets, and then the 6 week intelligence course. But then your real Army career begins, and then my real Army career began on July 2nd, and I was a good soldier. I did what they told me, and I didn't have to run or jump, and I was in my element. The only walking or running I had was getting to the parking lot. I got to the parking lot about 5:45, and I wasn't in the office until 6 o'clock. The place is so huge.
Now, tell me, I'm just curious. You were in the Army late 60s,
yes.
And you're writing this. You put this book out now. Why wait so long to share this story, or was it classified?
Well, no, it's not classified. I even give the code word in it, which I'm sure has been revealed through different sources. But I don't know. I just decided that maybe it was time for me to tell what was going on back then. It's a long time ago, and things have changed quite a bit. But I don't know. I thought I should have really written it a long time ago. I should have written it 20 years ago. But I was too busy becoming an attorney for quite a while. Then I semi-retired, and I said, you know, I had a pretty interesting job in the Pentagon. My legal career was very dull, and so I decided to put it down on paper, and sure enough, there were a lot of things that happened that way. You know, a lot of the stuff that happened didn't happen in the Pentagon. It happened during my Army career, but there were important things that happened in the Army. Some of them were tragic. And even the funny ones, even the tragic ones, there was a war between the Soviet Union and China, for example. Not, you know, many people know that, but it didn't last very long. And then the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia. That didn't last very long either. But I tell about, you know, the different characters I met there, and I met some pretty interesting guys.
Well, tell me, You mentioned earlier that you found it pretty daunting that you were called to work at the Pentagon. What's the biggest misconception that we as the public have about the Pentagon?
I guess that it's mysterious and filled with all sorts of military people. It's an office building. It's just that the people, instead of wearing suits and ties, most of them wear uniforms. The size of it, there are 30,000 people work in that building. I think that's more than any place else in the world. And it was, you meet a lot of people, and it's, there's an awful lot of walking to do because the place is so huge. So if one of the colonel said, get this report out to so-and-so, if you would, you know, you have to carry it. You might have to walk about half a mile because the place is just corridor after corridor after corridor. And as I said, the parking lot is it's like going to the stadium every day because it's so far away.
Give us an idea. Give us an idea of some of the levity that you experienced while working at the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of chapters there. Talk about, well, one thing that comes to mind is a guy that we had at our China desk. He was a guy, he was a freckle-faced Irish guy. You know, he was born here, but he learned Chinese. And, you know, I tell about his background a little bit. His assistant was a guy who didn't know anything about China until some guys found out that he was going to Vietnam. And I said, no, this is crazy. This is a guy very smart. He was a Rhodes Scholar, this guy. And, so they got the colonel to okay him as a China expert. He sort of crammed himself into learning all about China in about a month. And this was our Chinese desk officer. And there were others that were, I talk about a guy who was a ramrod type guy, just stiff, straight, crew cut. And he became a hippie. He left in March 69, went to Woodstock. Let his hair grow long, you know, wore the bead stuff, and he was a guy that turned in from an army guy to the most unarmy type guy you'd ever want to meet. As I said, he had the long hair and the beard and everything else. And there are about maybe 10, 15 characters, and one of the funniest chapter in the book is when we all went out to a luncheon that was provided by our desk officer, so we'd have either Chinese food or Hungarian food or Japanese food. And I tell about the time we went to a Jewish deli, and then we went to an Indian restaurant where the head of our Indian desk made a pass at me. So that was sort of a pretty funny story. And there are a lot of things that are in there, and as I said, my career was good. Good thing with the Army is it gave me a lot of vacation time. They gave me a month a year, so I had 2 months, and I went to Europe.
Did you have to get any kind of clearance to write this book?
Oh yeah, not to write the book, but I had a lot of clearance to get into the office that I went to. I mean, they interviewed my neighbors and my teachers, and this was a very, very sensitive type of position. There was a red phone, an actual red phone that we used. We'd get our reports every morning, which were very highly classified. These were one step above top secret, so these are pretty impressive things that were coming in. So we had that. We had the satellites going around, taking pictures, to make maps of the Soviet Union and China. I mean, I say all this now. I'd be shot if I said it 4 years ago. But
well,
now it's common knowledge.
We're glad you're not you're not giving away state secrets. The book is called The General's Briefer, written by Bob Woolsey. And Bob, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, goodbye now.
Bob Woolsey, author of The General's Briefer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0387, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A bank robber in Malvern, Pennsylvania, got $5,110 in cash and escaped in a cab. Things went downhill from there. He left a gym bag with more than $2,700 in the taxi, along with his driver's license and the sweatshirt he wore during the robbery. And he wrote his demand note on the back of the discharge papers from a drug and alcohol rehab center, which also noted his name. Police quickly tracked down and arrested 25-year-old Jamal Goodwin for robbery. Just a guess, but perhaps he didn't quite complete his rehab. Just a guess. And you know, some people are just too stupid to be allowed out unsupervised because why, oh why, would you rob a bank, leave half the loot and your ID in a getaway taxi, and write your robbery note on a form that included your full name? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0387. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0387. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.